Okay, yeah. So before I get started, I'm going to be out of town for the next class and then the next class as well. So two classes, I won't be here. And I talked to someone in the audiovisual room, and he said it would be fine if I record the classes ahead of time or if we did it via Zoom. But I think that's going to be problematic because we'll be attending services in Alabama. Even though it's central time, I don't think that'll quite work. So I think it's best to pre-record them. I'll double check with everybody else in there and make sure that's doable. And if not, does anybody want to teach the Gospel of John Wednesday and Sunday? So now there are men here who I'm sure are very capable. So we can do that if we need to. But I would like to record it, and that way I don't miss any. I would like to be able to teach the whole thing. So you'll find out Wednesday about that, all right? So we are in chapter 2, and as I said, we will get to chapter 3 today. At least that's the plan. I don't see why we wouldn't. And in chapter 3, we have that discussion with Nicodemus. And this is a different sort of narrative than we've seen before, but it's very much like what we see in chapter 4. It's also like what we see elsewhere in the Gospel of John. But there's a certain continuity between chapters 1, chapter 2, chapters 1 and 2, and then chapter 3 as well, and 4, as we will see. We kind of had to stop at an unfortunate point on Wednesday. We were halfway through the discussion of the miracle at Cana, and I hated that because it was a little bit, as I said, unfortunate. So I want to finish that up and then get to the second text of chapter 2. So I want to remind you of a few things. I'm not going to rehearse everything, but I do want to remind you of a few things. Right? So they're at this wedding feast that presumably lasted several days. Wine is an important part of the festival of this, and it's an important part specifically as it pertains to the host of the wedding feast. If the host or hosts run out of wine, that's going to be a shameful situation. Remember, we're operating within the framework of honor and shame society. These are transactions that take place in public. So if you run out of wine, this is one of those things that's going to lose you honor points, if you will. It reminds me of like a video game. There's a meter of honor and shame, and depending upon your actions, that goes up or down, right, towards honor or towards shame. So that's the issue. Well, Jesus doesn't allow that to happen. He restores and actually increases the honor, as we'll see from a passage in just a minute. But what's the real point of this sign? And as I said last time, I think the clue is in verse 6. These stone water pots are for Jewish rites of purification. And what Jesus does then is he turns that water into something better. And again, I don't think this is just something that John says in passing. Oh, these were water. These are water jars. And they're for Jewish rites of purification. No, I mean, why does he even mention that? If it's just about turning water to wine and just about showing how powerful Jesus is, why bother saying that? I think that's on purpose. And it's on purpose to show Jesus is turning not just any water, but waters of purification into something better. And that's the wine. I think that's what this is all about. And it fits pretty well with what we said in chapter 1 about John's baptism in comparison to other cleansing rituals. And it's going to speak volumes in chapter 3 as well when we see that contrast. So it fits so well. But also, it's a bigger discussion of what Jesus is doing. Is he's inaugurating essentially a new Torah or a new way to follow God, a new way to have a relationship with God. That's also more generally what's at stake in this miracle. Okay, so here's his discussion with his mother. We don't have to say much about this because we talked about it last time, but I do want to say a couple of things. And I want to ask a question. Does this say anything about Mary's faith, what she says to Jesus? And I know that's maybe a little bit strange, right? Mary's faith in Jesus? And I say it's strange because she's been around Jesus his whole life. But still, does this show faith? What do you think? Yeah. In what sense? And I think there are two potential answers. Right.
She's not giving that. There's a reason for that. She knows, at least at the surface level, he can do something about it.
Yep. I think that's it. He can do something about it, and he will do something about it, right? So I think those are the two potential answers. Jesus has the power, but he also has the desire, right? We have stories where people come up to Jesus and they say, if you desire to make me well. Well, of course he does. And here he has the desire to change this situation for these hosts. All right, so then continuing in the text, he tells the attendants to fill the jars with water. They filled them to the brim. And he says, draw some out. Now this is interesting in verse 9. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine, he did not know where it came from. Here's another motif in the Gospel of John, and that's the motif of ignorance. How many times, and I don't know the answer to this, so I'll just give the very scientific answer, a bunch is the answer. How many times does that happen? Where the text explicitly says someone doesn't understand something, or it's implied. Over and over again this happens, right? And I think it reinforces the idea of John 14:6, that Jesus is the truth. He's the way to understand how things really are, right? And so we have the ignorance. I know here it's on a literal level. He doesn't know how it happened. But then it says, though, the servants who had drawn the water knew. It's tempting to say, here we have, like we have so many times in the gospel of John, a double entendre. That is, it says something on the literal level, but on the metaphorical level, maybe it means something else, and that is, it has something to do with the people who believe in Jesus. Or is it typically the leaders? Is it typically the people like the steward here? Or is it servants? Is it the lower class citizens? That's tempting. But I wouldn't say, yeah, that's definitely what's going on. All right, but then verse 10, he says basically, and I'll just say this as the kids say, everyone serves the good wine first. He's flipped the script, as the kids say. That's what I meant. That's what I was getting at. Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine comes after the guests have become drunk. But you've kept the good wine until now. Right, so he's saying that typically what happens, you serve the best wine first. People say, oh, this is such good wine, and it's so good. They get drunk, and then they can't tell the difference when you serve them the pathetic wine. He says, you've done it the other way around. You've served not such good stuff first, and the best stuff last. What does this say about the kind of wine that Jesus produced? It was the best. It was better than what they had served previously. Which again, I think speaks to this idea that Jesus has produced something better. That's the point. Jesus has turned something that was good into something better. And that reminds me of what we said in chapter 1 when there's this comparison of the law with Jesus. It's not that the law is terrible, and it's not that these purification rituals are just awful. No, it's that they're good. It's just what Jesus provides is better. That's the idea. Okay? Anything else about this before we move on? Okay, now there's an important chronological note here, and I mention that because it's important. After this, it says that Jesus returns to Capernaum. Okay, so he goes from Cana to Capernaum. And then it says this miracle at Cana was the first of his signs. So remember those two things. So in the narrative, where is Jesus at this point, Capernaum? How many miracles has he performed in the Gospel of John? One, the miracle at Cana. Okay, so remember that as we go forward. Because the next thing doesn't happen at Capernaum. The next thing happens in Jerusalem. The next verse after the one I just mentioned says Jesus goes up to Jerusalem, which I think indicates something about the chronology, as I'll say in a minute. All right, so the cleansing of the temple is one of those things that occurs in all the synoptics, and it occurs in the Gospel of John. It's one of the very few things, other than the final week, that occurs in all four Gospels. You got this, you got the feeding of the 5,000, you have the walking on water. That's about it. It's incredible to think. That's about the only narratives that cohere with the synoptics explicitly. There are some others that are maybe more difficult to say, yeah, this is the same event as this. And we'll get to that later. But anyway, cleansing of the temple. But here's the problem. Where does it occur in the synoptics? It's at the end. Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's at the end of his ministry, and in fact, it's one of those events. I won't say it's the event, but it's one of those events that pushes the Jewish leaders over the edge. And it says, we got to do something about this guy. And I think that's important to remember. Why would that be sort of the tipping point in the synoptics, do you think? When Jesus comes into the temple, he overturns them, he uses a whip, as we see here in John, and causes a pretty big ordeal. Why would that be the tipping point, do you think? Yep, it's disruptive. You said absolutely disruptive. And it's disruptive in so many different ways, right? So that's important. So, all right, let's assume he does this at the beginning. Because the solution to this problem is, well, you got two cleansings. You've got one temple cleansing at the beginning. You got another one at the end. Problem solved. Not really. Think about what Jesus said to his mother at the wedding at Cana. What does he say when she says, hey, they have no wine? Remember what he says? Anybody remember? What does he say? Time has not yet come. Why does he say that? You remember? We talked about this last time. Why does he say that? He's what?
The attention that he's the one who gets that miracle.
It's not time for it. Now, the issue is, and I didn't mention this, but the issue is he does it. He goes ahead and does it anyway. But I think it still sets the paradigm to his mother that, look, I can't be going around doing this kind of stuff. I don't want to get much attention. And then in the very next narrative, we have Jesus going to the temple and getting about the most attention you could possibly get. That just doesn't make any sense to me. That just doesn't work, frankly. So I don't think this is chronological. I don't think there are two cleansings. I think John puts this at the beginning for thematic reasons. Now, it bothers people because they assume that the Gospel of John must be strictly chronological. And if it's not strictly chronological, maybe it's not historical. Well, that doesn't necessarily follow, right? It doesn't have to be chronological to be historical. Those are not the same things. Now, the problem comes in because, and I'll just ask you, is John chronological at all? Yeah, he is. He begins very much like the synoptics do with the preaching of John the Baptist, right? He ends very much like they do with the resurrection appearances. So, does John care about chronology? Yeah, he does. But does that mean every single thing in the gospel has to be chronological? No, it doesn't. And I would even add to that a question, does everything in the synoptics have to be chronological? No, they don't. And I don't think they are in the synoptics either. So then it's worth asking, Why does John change the chronology so much here? Why does he put this right here after the wedding at Cana, after the discussion in chapter 1 about the Jewish leaders coming to John and saying, why are you baptizing? What does this have to do with those things? All right? And so we'll answer that question in just a minute. So I guess just to make this very clear, I don't really see any great arguments for there being two cleansings. I could be wrong. Of course, I could be wrong. I just don't really see them. Anybody have any questions or comments about that? Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. He comes to cleanse the temple the second time. They're like, yeah, we've seen this show before, right? Let's just go ahead and arrest him. We know what he's going to do. Yeah, that's a really good point. I didn't think about it like that. Yeah, good. What else? Anybody else have anything about this? Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah, good. Yeah, good point. Somebody else? Yeah. Yeah.
From what I've heard, I may be wrong, so you can clarify this. The Jewish leaders in the temple courts were upset that Jesus overturned the carts and the money makers and just disturbed that because they also got a take. And they were disturbing their income to the drinking take under the table. Is that true or did I just say that?
I mean, that could be part of it. But I don't know that the sources make that explicit. And the best source for that would be Josephus. But Josephus sometimes says stuff that's probably not true. So, but would some of the leaders receive a kickback from this, the money they made? It's hard not to think that. So, yeah, I think that probably is true, at least to some degree. Yeah. Right. So take George Washington's biography. What are they probably going to begin with? Right? Anybody know?
His birth,
they might. But if you want to get the reader's attention, you probably begin with something else, maybe more well-known. Why is that? It's thematic, to get people's attention. Why does John begin the way that he does? Thematic, to get people's attention. So, yeah, I think that's a good point. Okay, so let's look at the text then of the cleansing of the temple. Notice Passover is mentioned. Passover is so important to the Gospel of John. Okay, so let's dissect this a little bit. So in the temple, you got people selling cattle, sheep, and doves. Why are they in the temple? I mean, why are they selling these things?
People traveling for sacrifices.
Yep. Right. It's too much trouble. It's completely impractical, right? So, is that legitimate? To be selling these animals in the temple complex, is that legitimate? Seems like it to me. Makes sense. Okay? Money changers. Why do you have money changers? Yeah. You got
different.
Exactly. Different currencies. You got to have this changed out or it's not going to work. Does that make sense? Yeah, of course it does. Completely practical. So I point that out to say it's easy to look at what Jesus is condemning and saying, he's saying they shouldn't be doing this at all. Is that really what he's saying, though? I mean, That's impractical. But somebody may say, serving God's not all about practicality, which is a really good point. It's not. But in this particular situation, I mean, does Jesus really expect the Jewish leaders to say, you know what, Jesus is right. Let's take all these animals out of here and let's just figure out some other way. They'll just have to bring them themselves. I don't think that's really what he expects. Let's look at what he says. He does say, take these things out of here. Stop making my father's house a marketplace. Again, that sounds like, all right, he wants them out of there. They ought to just do away with the whole thing. I think what's happening, though, and especially when you look at what the synoptics have to say, and it's very tempting to look at that now, but I'm not going to do that because we're studying John, and we don't really have the time to do that every time we might want to. But I think what he's getting at is they've turned this into a business first and foremost. It's not about worshiping God anymore. It's about making money. It's about giving people maybe a little bit off the top. When you exchange money, how easy is it to give somebody or to take back less than what you should be getting back? I say that from personal experience with a cab driver in a country where we tried to exchange it, and he did it so fast, like it didn't have time to compute. This isn't enough money. He took more money than he should have. You think they're doing that here? Oh, yeah. It's hard to imagine them not. I think that's what Jesus is getting at. And again, I could be wrong about that. But more importantly, look at what the Jews say. What sign can you show us for doing this? They want some miraculous sign to demonstrate his authority to do something so crazy. I mean, this is one of those things where he comes in here and it's like, who on earth do you think you are? I mean, he's, as John said, absolutely disruptive. No one does this. Who do you think you are? What authority do you have for doing these things? So they want him to perform some miracle. So Jesus says, all right, this is it. Destroy this temple. In 3 days, I will raise it up. And they say, this is ridiculous. It took 46 years to build this temple. And you're going to raise it up in 3 days if it gets destroyed? It's crazy, right? Well, what's he talking about? He was speaking of the temple of his body. And after he was raised, the disciples remember what he said here. Okay. So often in John, though, that's not the only thing going on. Jesus is making a play on this temple being destroyed. But is he also predicting the destruction of the temple? Yeah, I believe so. It was destroyed in 70 AD. It's never been rebuilt. You can go to Jerusalem today. You're going to see the Temple Mount, which in all pictures of Jerusalem that I've seen, the easiest thing to pick out is the mosque in Jerusalem. The Dome of the Rock, it's a Muslim holy site. That's not the temple. It's on the Temple Mount. It's on the location where scholars or archaeologists think it was. But it's not there. So this is a monumental event. Get it? Because, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry. Not really. but thank you. Thank you. Right. You're right.
For their sacrifices. They were supposed to bring.
You're right.
And if you, I'm not saying let's look at the synoptics, but if you look at the synoptics, the insinuation, at least in my mind, with them mentioning the doves and every one of them, is that they were cheating the poor people. Because the dove is what that would have been
right.
Wronged by the poor person.
Yep.
But it all started with, they went away from a pattern.
Yep.
The pattern was, bring your sacrifice and offer it.
You're right.
And
yeah.
It's not thinking about God first. And that's where all of this kind of had its genesis.
Yeah.
It ended up something like this.
Yeah. You're right. I mean, that's very possible. So like I said, I could be wrong. Maybe that's correct. I don't know. And it's worth thinking about. And really, your interpretation fits better with what Jesus literally says here. I guess I'm thinking about it maybe from a more practical standpoint, but like I said earlier, maybe it's not about practicality, because it has that principle again. Serving God isn't necessarily practical. It's not about practicality. So, yeah, I think that's a very good possibility. Okay, so two things here. Jesus is predicting the destruction of the temple, but he's also predicting his own destruction, if you will, but also his resurrection. So what is all this doing then? It's a judgment upon the temple. Why is it a judgment upon the temple? How does this fit with what we've talked about before? We'll get to that in just a minute. Any questions or comments before we move on? I wanted to read these verses because of a couple of things that are said there. Okay, so when he was in Jerusalem during the Passover festival, many believed in his name because they saw the signs he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, would not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to testify about anyone, for he himself knew what was in everyone. So many things here that are motifs that we've seen before. We've got the Passover mentioned again. We've got the notion of testimony, right? 25. Jesus doesn't need the testimony of other people. Do we readers need testimony? Yeah, we do. We need John's testimony about Jesus that we saw so many times in chapter 1. We also need the Holy Spirit's testimony about Jesus, which was also mentioned in chapter 1. We need the record of the sign at Cana, which has to do with testimony for readers, right? But he doesn't need that. But notice it says he wouldn't entrust himself to them because he knew all people. What does that mean? Why does the text say that, do you think? You got people who believe or are believing in Jesus because of what he's done, but Jesus doesn't entrust himself to them. What is implied here? And this gets explained in more detail later on, more explicitly. Anybody know? Yeah. I think that's it. And he doesn't entrust himself to them. He doesn't trust them. He doesn't believe in them, which is an incredible concept. And I remember I heard a sermon years ago, and the sermon was, "Does God believe in you?" That's scary to think about, right? But Jesus says he doesn't trust them because he knows their motivations. He doesn't have to ask somebody and say, "Hey, what do you know about this person?" He doesn't have to do that. He knows them. And he knows that they were impressed by signs, but they didn't necessarily believe in who Jesus was and what he was saying, right? I think that's the point. Okay, so we've got the wedding at Cana. We have the prophecy of the destruction of the temple, the cleansing of the temple, and then we have this discussion with Nicodemus in chapter 3. What is all this about? And it answers this question, how does one have a relationship with God? That's another thing that we see here in John. It's not through Jewish purification ritual, which is, I think, also a part for the whole with reference to the law. It's not about the law, which of course Paul will say. Paul uses language of justification most often, but still, it's the same point. It's not through the temple. The temple is going to be destroyed, and the temple isn't what it should be, right? But it's through the true water ritual of Jesus, because in his discussion of Nicodemus, as we know, guess what? He brings up the subject of water. Remember, I talked about last time how this is a motif over and over again, especially in the first part of the Gospel of John, water. Well, what is the nuance when John talks about water? Is it always baptism? That's a question we'll ask here in a minute about chapter 3. But at least to me, I think this is how all these stories fit together. And back to the question of why does John put the cleansing of the temple where he does? I think that's the answer. He wants to answer that question. that it's not about the temple anymore. The temple isn't what it should be, and the temple is going to be destroyed. Can you imagine what that would have done to the Jewish people when the temple was destroyed in AD 70? And that's something that maybe we don't think as much about, because we know in the New Testament we're maybe concerned about what it did to Christians. I think, by the way, Hebrews might very well be a response after the destruction of the temple. What do we do? What do we make of Judaism now? I think maybe that's it, but that's beside the point. Some early rabbinic texts have laws specifically about the temple, and it raises a question. Were these written before the temple was destroyed, or were they written afterward? And the people fully expect the temple to be rebuilt any minute. I think you probably have both in the Mishnah. But it's weird, because these texts are dated to about 200. Is it possible you got people in the second century who are thinking, Jewish people, who are thinking the temple is going to be rebuilt any minute? Why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they? It is symbolically the place that has identified them with God, right? That's what it's all about. And it's destroyed. Now what? Big questions have to be answered at this point for Judaism. But in the Gospel of John, Jesus becomes the new temple in a way of thinking. And I think that, again, makes sense of what he just said when he says, you destroy the temple, and in 3 days I'll rebuild it again. And notice the text says he's talking about the temple of his body, the temple that is his body. How do you have a relationship with God? It's through Jesus and through his death on the cross, right? So I think that's how all this fits together. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Nicodemus now. A lot's been made of the fact that he comes at night. Well, instead of saying why this might happen on a literal level first, John's playing with another image. This time, it's the distinction between darkness and light. So when does Nicodemus come to see Jesus? It's at night. But in 19, verse 39, chapter 19, verse 39 of John, what is Nicodemus doing? Anybody remember? Anybody remember? He's helping prepare Jesus for burial. So I think we could say he's coming into the light, because in this same text, verses 20 and 21, Jesus says, "For all who do evil hate the light and do not come to the light, that their deeds may not be exposed. But those who do what's true come to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that their deeds have been done in God." I think this helps answer the question why he comes at night. It's symbolic of his state, right? Like, he's a disciple, or he wants to be a disciple, but it's like a secret disciple. I mean, why would he come at night, literally? Let's get that out of the way. Why would he do that? He doesn't want to be seen. And I think at this point, if this is early in Jesus' ministry, it may not necessarily be the case that, the Pharisees would just, persecute Nicodemus if they saw it. It may not necessarily be that. I don't know what their level of opposition was toward Jesus at this specific point. It could simply be that he just didn't want people to know. He was actually interested in what this nobody had to say. He's a closet disciple, maybe, right? Wow. Well, we could do a lot with that, right? As the old guys say, not really, but as some preachers say, that'll preach, right? We could do something with that. And I think maybe that's what he's getting at. Okay, so I think with Nicodemus, the other thing mentioned in verse 1 is he's a Pharisee. Here we have a situation that I think is so important in so many respects, practically speaking, today. And I don't want to go off on a sermonette with this, because I could easily do that. So I'll just say, I'll just try to make this as brief as possible. He's a Pharisee. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we could say all the Pharisees of Jesus' time were hypocrites? And they were unbelievers. Is that a true statement? Nope, it's not true, because we have an exception right here. And I assume There were others. Josephus says there are thousands of Pharisees at the time of Jesus. Thousands. So when you have a condemnation of the Pharisees, it's not every single one of them. It's the few that Jesus is dealing with. So in Matthew 23, Jesus condemns the Pharisees. Is he condemning all, you know, however many thousands of them? No. He's condemning the ones with whom he has had discussions. They're hypocrites. But is Nicodemus a hypocrite? Not necessarily. Yeah. 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 The Sadducees, I mean, that's a good question. They clearly represent a different way of thinking about Judaism. They believe different things, right? For example, the Sadducees only thought the first five books of the Pentateuch were worth paying attention to. Or, I mean, the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, were necessary to be paid attention to. They didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in angels or anything like that. It's probably because they're not explicitly mentioned in the Pentateuch, although angels are, so it's a bit, maybe that's not it. But this is why, when they have a discussion with Jesus about the resurrection, he doesn't quote, you know, Daniel or something. He quotes the Pentateuch, because he knows that's what they believe. So, yeah, they believe different things. The Pharisees, we might say, are more traditional. And what they believe actually is quite a bit closer to what later Christians would believe too. They believed, the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. They believed in the importance of keeping God's commandments. And from our perspective, we look at the Pharisees and we say, well, they added a bunch of stuff to it. They added all these traditions that are mentioned in the New Testament. And okay, from our perspective, that's what happened. But that's not what they thought they were doing. No, they thought God revealed this to us. And it was to protect his word so that we don't disobey it. It's very noble. We may disagree with it, but it's very noble. So, when we condemn an entire group of people, how is that fair? We don't know every single person, right, of that group. So you can't condemn a group of people. Maybe you've had negative experiences with a few from a much larger group of people. Does that mean you just condemn everybody? No, it doesn't. It's kind of like if you've heard people say this before, well, I don't go to church services because there are hypocrites there. Well, are there hypocrites in a lot of local congregations? Yeah, there are. Does that mean all of them are? I doubt it. I seriously hope not. You can't condemn an entire group of people like that. Okay, so, sermonette over. Nicodemus is a Pharisee. He comes at night. He comes to Jesus and he says, Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher who's come from God, for no one can do the signs you do apart from the presence of God. Let's be careful here, because it's easy to read verse 2 and say, oh, he thinks Jesus is God in the flesh. No. Not quite. All he's simply saying is, God is with you. God is helping you in some way, otherwise you couldn't do these things. He's not saying only God in the flesh, like John 1:14. Only God in the flesh could do what you're doing. He's not saying that. But he is saying, you have the power of God with you to be able to do these things. So, how is this connected? How does Nicodemus' statement connected to what Jesus says? Because what Jesus says seems to have absolutely nothing to do with what Nicodemus says and have no connection whatsoever. Well, I think it's the construction, no one can. I think that's all it is. No one can do these signs that you do. And Jesus says, very truly I tell you, no one can see the kingdom of God without being born from above. Or again, I'll explain that in a minute. So what does he do? He takes the emphasis away from what he's doing, Jesus, and he puts it on Nicodemus. But he puts it on all believers, right? Forget what I'm doing. This is what you need to do. It's incredible. Now, given what we saw in chapter 2, that statement that Jesus knows what people are thinking. Jesus knows people's motivations. He knows Nicodemus needs to hear this. Nicodemus, and by the way, is Nicodemus being insincere in his question? Does Nicodemus really believe that? Yeah, I see no reason to doubt it. If the guy's willing to go to the trouble of going at night to ask Jesus this question, I don't think he's trying to trip him up or whatever. He's legitimately saying these things. It's a statement. But he's clearly got something on his heart, something on his mind. Jesus knows what it is. And Jesus says, no one can see the kingdom of God without being born again, is the usual translation. But probably it's from above. But you might say, well, that's not how Nicodemus understands it. Well, again, remember the motif of misunderstanding. Yes, Nicodemus misunderstands it because this word can mean above. It can mean again. It can mean both. Here is another case where I think it's purposefully ambiguous. By the way, does it matter which it is that much? Not really. Whether it's born again or born from, it doesn't matter that much, right? Nicodemus says, how can anybody be born after they've grown old? I mean, you can't enter into your mother's womb and then be born again, right? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And Jesus says, truly I tell you, no one can enter the kingdom of God without being born of water and the Spirit. So what Jesus says in verse 5 helps to clarify Nicodemus' misunderstanding. Again, misunderstanding, Jesus' correction. But Jesus doesn't make the correction so obvious. What does he mean when he mentions water here? Some argue that he's talking about, liquid that takes place when you're born, right? Like natural birth. That's what he's talking about. That's what some people argue. So you've got natural birth. This is the first birth. But then you have a second birth that's through the Spirit. I mean, really, that makes sense given what Nicodemus says. He says, can you enter a second time into the mother's womb? No. You've already been born that way through water. You've got to be born through the Spirit now. So it makes sense, but I don't know that that's the best understanding. Right? We're not looking for possibilities because there are a lot of possibilities. We're looking for what's most plausible, what has the better evidence. Well, let's see what he says after this, and it'll make sense. But before we do that, this language about being born again, very similar phrase is found in Plato. So let's just read this together, and then I think you'll be able to see the connection, well, hopefully. As to the words of the poets, that's not or the poets, that's of the poets, they are these. Consider now if you think that they speak the truth. All right, so think about what they're saying. It's all he means. He mentioned Pindar by name, and he quotes probably from Pindar. But anyway, they said that the soul of man is immortal. And at one time comes to an end, which is called dying. Right? Makes sense? Not difficult. And at another time is born again. Perfectly legitimate translation. And again, it's not exactly the same as what John has, but it's very close. It's born again and never perishes. What is he talking about? Well, we skip ahead a little bit in the text. Seeing then that the soul is immortal, has been born many times, has beheld all things in this world and in the nether realms, she, the soul, has acquired knowledge of all and everything. So it's no wonder that she should be able to recollect all that she knew before about virtue and other things. Anybody know what he's talking about here? You're born many times. Reincarnation. Very good. You may not expect that from Greek texts, but in Greek philosophy, there's a whole history of people who believed in reincarnation. Is that what John's talking about? Absolutely not. Okay, And I'll make that clear on Wednesday. Thank you. Sorry, such an abrupt ending, but...